Hey, everybody. Welcome to another episode of the Vertical Podcast with Chris Mannix. This week on the show is Mike Dunleavy, the former NBA coach who has reinvented himself as a college coach down at Tulane. I asked Mike about how his coaching style changes with college kids.
I mean, there's certain things I might say to an NBA player that I wouldn't say to a college player. I mean, you have to take into consideration their age, their maturity. You know, in some cases, they're fragile.
And we look back at some of the crazy teams he coached, including the early 2000 Portland Trailblazers.
Early on when I got there, I told Bob Whitsitt, look, you got tremendous athletes here and you've made the playoffs the last 5 years, but you've been knocked out in the first round every year. And big part of it is you win with character. I think some of these guys don't have the right character.
Some housekeeping first. If you like this podcast or any of our previous podcasts, please hit iTunes, give us a rating, post a comment. It's easy. It's the best way you can support this podcast. That's it. That's all I ask. All right, let's go. Well, Mike Dunleavy was part of the NBA for the parts, at least, of four decades as a player, as an assistant coach, and then as a head coach. He has changed course later in his career and gone into the college ranks. Now the head coach down at Tulane with the Green Wave, his first season wrapping up. And Mike joins me here on the podcast. Mike, thanks for joining me. I appreciate it.
My pleasure, Chris.
So now that you're kind of through or almost through this first year, your expectations for what this year was going to be like coming into the season versus the reality of them, how close have they matched up for you?
It's pretty good, actually. I decided to move to the college ranks after, a couple of years. I was looking at pro jobs, certain jobs I was interested in, certain jobs I wasn't interested in, and I didn't get the ones I was interested in. And I was spending a lot of time at Villanova with my son Baker, who was the associate head coach there, and with Jay Wright. And then I was spending some time down at SMU with Larry Brown. And I just loved the teaching part of the game. And I was sitting there in practices and I was saying, this really appeals to me. And I think it's something, I could do for the next 10 or 15 years. I just have to find the right city to do it. And, a lot of it was about location. As far as I think I can build a program, I think what I have to offer, to kids as far as, hey, if you want to be an NBA player, you're going to be playing in a system that's going to translate very well to the NBA. You won't skip a beat leaving our practice facility, going to an NBA practice facility for a training camp. And, along the way, I've been pretty good at picking talent that can play for me. I've picked six all-stars in the last, in 12 years as a general manager, I picked six all-stars. I know guys that, can play for me, and I'm hoping that's going to translate as well, at the college ranks.
What's the team or the player from your pro experience that your kids now maybe want to hear a lot about or are more familiar with?
Well, a lot of them have known. Magic Johnson, they want to know about Magic Johnson for sure. Ray Allen, a guy I drafted, Blake Griffin, of course, DeAndre Jordan. There's just so many guys. Eric Gordon just won a 3-point contest. When I talk in terms of guys that I've drafted and guys that I've coached, I've coached so many, good ones that are relevant, still today, obviously. And, I get questions about all of them and certain guys, as far as, we get a lot of guys running through here, coming to our practice facility to practice in the off seasons. And we just had, Chris Paul was in here during the All-Star game, and our freshman point guard, Ray Onoembo, had a chance to, sit with him and work out a little bit with him and ask him some, great questions. Chris, when you were a freshman at Wake Forest, how did you lead older, classmen? How did you get their respect? And, just some great questions. And, Chris was really, really great at, answering them and giving them good insight and how to be a leader and, what parts of the game, to work on. So, we got a lot of things to offer. And, again, I get lots of, varying questions because of, obviously we advertise a little bit of, when we're drafting guys, when we're recruiting kids, about guys I've drafted and guys who I've coached.
There's a certain lifestyle, Mike, that you get afforded as an NBA player and, of course, as an NBA coach. And as you transition to college, that lifestyle is certainly, probably significantly different. You go from private jets to high-end hotels, and I would imagine the lifestyle at Tulane is is a little bit different than that, including the fact the type of gyms you're playing in and the locker rooms and things like that. I mean, has it been at all kind of humbling in some way to go from?
Not at all.
Okay.
Not at all. I'm a gym rat from Brooklyn.
Mm.
I've been in all the gyms. I've been all the places. You know, to me, it's the way I grew up. It's nothing. I mean, although one of the things that attracted me to Tulane, people ask me, why Tulane? I said, well, it's really a hidden gem. People don't know it. It's a gorgeous campus in a great city. A lot of things going on here. Obviously, pro sports, you know, basketball and football, the Pelicans and the Saints. And we get Final Fours and All-Star games and lots of people coming through here. Great music, great food. But the practice facility here is as good as any NBA practice facility. So the place that I go to work, my laboratory every single day is as good as any NBA team. And, I think we travel well and stay in nice hotels and all that's good. So really for me, none of that. I mean, the one place I will say this, yeah, locker rooms on the road, locker rooms on the road at times are, go take me back to the early beginnings of my NBA career in some of the locker rooms we had, particularly, you know, when you play preseason games, certain places. I'm like, wait, whose closet is this, you know, that we're all trying to, you know, get dressed in and watch some film or, you know, but other than that, nothing. It's great. I mean, I absolutely love it. The kids are terrific. They work really hard. They're engaged. You know, they want to get better. And I think our team has gotten a lot better as the season's gone on. We just had a nice win over Tulsa, and we're getting ready to start our conference tournament. But our guys have played really well against some of the top teams in the country. We played North Carolina even for a half, and we were up 15 at SMU. So there's lots of things to build on, and we got a good recruiting class coming in for next year. So things are great. I'm really happy about my decision to do this and not just try to take any NBA job that was offered.
Is coaching just kind of coaching, Mike? In other words, do you have to tailor your coaching style from what you were as an NBA coach to what you are now?
No, I do the same thing. Basically, you know, I always look at it from a coaching standpoint. Is my job as a coach is to try and make players better and to put them in a system that their talents will thrive the best in at that given time. And then as you go forward and acquire different talent, you may change to other things that you might want to do. But, whatever your talent is, you got to play to that, you know, until it changes.
Do you have to simplify the playbook at all? I mean, you were known as an NBA coach as having something of a thick playbook.
Yeah, no, look, I have a huge playbook. So does Greg Popovich. But for me, it's actually, I think, it's simple because, you know, mine is based on a numbering system. Well, back when I was an assistant coach with Milwaukee and I was out scouting games, this is way before all the games were on satellite TV and you had to physically go scout, you know, I'm sitting there writing, you know, what plays are down and I feel like my head is down half the time and I'm asking the guy next to me, hey, what was the backside of that play on the weak side? How did they end that play? Because I was drawing the front side of it. And I decided that I put numbers on every NBA action. So basically it becomes a shorthand. So we really speak in numbers and we just stack number on top of a number that has a meaning. And it's just, once you learn the numbers, you can virtually do anything and you can describe it both offensively and defensively. So it can be a big playbook, but I think it's an easy one to understand.
Is there a certain way, I guess, that you could talk to NBA players that maybe you can't with college kids or vice versa? Maybe there's something that you can say to a college kid that maybe you would never say to an NBA guy.
No, it goes the other way. I mean, there's certain things I might say to an NBA player that I wouldn't say to a college player. I mean, you have to take into consideration their age, their maturity. In some cases, they're fragile a little bit, you know, more so than you would think than NBA players who have gone through the experience a little bit more. I think it's all about knowing your players and knowing the best way to get through to them. You know, the first thing you have to figure out is, you know, when you're talking to a player, trying to teach a player, is he a guy that, you know, when he hears it, is that the way he learns, or is it visual, you have to show him, or is it physical, you have to actually take him on the court and demonstrate, And sometimes it's all the above, but certain guys, you know, do things, you know, better than others, and you have to figure that out about them. But clearly, you know, I would say to you, I definitely don't go as harsh at some of my players in college than I would as I would in the NBA.
Is it fun to you know, kind of be able to shape some of these guys from a young age? I was listening to Kevin Garnett recently on TV say, you know, basically that AAU basketball has destroyed the NBA, or that these kids that come in, they just don't have the fundamentals, stuff that I'm sure you've heard before and seen before. But, you know, now when you get these guys at 17, 18 years old, there's just something that you like about just kind of being able to mold players at such a young age.
I do. But, you know, I hear the complaints all the time about European players versus U.S. players. And I think that we do U.S. players an injustice here. And a big part of it is because of the rules. Like, for instance, in the NCAA, once our season ends, you go to kind of the summer rules. You get 8 hours to work with your kids a week, which sounds, you know, actually, so as far as I would be concerned, 8 hours is good, except only 2 of those 8 hours can be on a basketball court, which, while, you know, European kids, you know, on their own are spending way, way more time, 2 or 3 times that amount of time, you know, getting individual instruction and skill work. And, you know, we have to turn our players down. They call us about, you know, getting more shots up or more work in. And we've got to turn them down saying, look, no, we've already used up our 2 hours this week, you know, which is just ludicrous. I mean, I get, you know, I make this claim and people say to me, well, coach, you know, a couple of years ago, we didn't have anything. I'm like, well, that's even dumber. That doesn't mean you can't talk out about something right now. I mean, if somebody said to you, hey, I'm going to give you 8 hours a week with the kids, you got to decide as a coach what's best for them as far as conditioning, weightlifting, or playing. You know, you don't think a coach is going to pick the right mix for what that kid needs. That's the only thing as far as the college game to me that just is crazy. And the only thing that I would rail against and, you know, and try and to see to get changed at some point in time is that, you know, everybody's complaining about how other kids are better skilled players. Well, yes, because in the off season, you give us 2 hours a week to work with kids, whereas, you know, other places probably getting 10 hours, 20 hours a week still. I mean, you know, European players. So that'd be the one, that's the only place, as far as I'm concerned, where I would be at a little bit of odds, you know, as far as NCAA versus pro.
I was reading the New York Times story about you in the program recently, and one thing kind of jumped off the page at me was you sort of talked about how much you like recruiting. And that would be something I would think that would be something an NBA coach maybe wouldn't be as thrilled about, because recruiting is, I mean, it's not just a certain cycle. I mean, recruiting really is kind of a 24/7 sort of endeavor. What is it about recruiting that you've taken to?
Well, I mean, I like people, first off. I like dealing with people. Travel doesn't bother me. I can be on a plane 5 days a week, you know, seeing somebody and doing it. I mean, I want to see all our guys. Like my son Baker said to me one time, he goes, Dad, why are you going to see that guy? Like, can you get him? And I said, well, I'm not sure. He says, well, look, your assistant's got to put you in front of guys that you know you can get. And I said, well, no, because I need to see guys to determine how good they are, whether I can get them or not get them. So I can gauge those really great players who are, you know, supposedly great players against other guys to know their value. And I enjoy doing it. I enjoy seeing players and talking to players. And the other part of it is that, you know, I get to, you know, have a chance to get out there and talk up our program. And I'm a little bit behind in the sense that, you know, I haven't grown up in this business, but I do have something, you know, good to sell. And basically when people see you come into their gym and say, wow, you showed up to come to this gym to a workout or to see our guy, you traveled all this way, I, you know, I think it means something for them. And you know, and the difference for me is, you know, I don't need a lot of what the other guys need. Like, I'm not trying to jump from this program to another program to the next program to a bigger and better school. I'm happy right where I am. I made this decision. I'm here to build a program, to teach kids how to play, to teach them about life too. There's lots of things, you know, I mean, I spent a lot of time, you know, doing stuff off the court between broadcasting and Wall Street. And there's lots of different, you know, directions that I can help kids and point them.
You do have a great campus down there, and I agree with you, kind of an underrated school. I haven't been down there in a few years, but when I was there visiting once, it's great. It's a beautiful place. down at Tulane. But when, you know, coaches, when they're recruiting, you know, they play to their strengths. Your strength, I would imagine, is that, you know, you've got the NBA kind of pedigree, and you can tell kids that, you know, I can help you maybe get to this point. I mean, is that how much of a carrot is that for you as you're trying to recruit kids?
Oh, it's big. Yeah, of course. It's huge. You know, for players who, you know, they want to try and get to the next level. Okay. They need the right direction. You know, I mean, being a general manager in the NBA, you see so many kids being advised, you know, to go out early. In some cases, like I'm a proponent of letting kids come out of high school. I mean, so it's not like I'm not saying they shouldn't come out early. I think the NBA, if, you know, if I was king for a day, I'd say, okay, hey, anybody out of high school can trick, or either you're good enough or you can trick an NBA team into picking you in the first round and getting 3 years guaranteed, then nobody should be able to stop you from earning that living. Okay. And in some cases it's too much money, because sometimes you're not that, you know, you may not be that guy, and you may never, you go to college for a year or whatever, and you get exposed. Maybe you're never going to see that money again. So somebody stopped you from getting that money when you could have gotten it. So I'm a believer in that, but then to give that up, I would like to keep kids in school for a couple of years. If you weren't good enough to go to the NBA the first time around, then you should have to stay for 2 years, because you're going to get better coaching. It's going to have you better prepared. You'll be ready, you know, and you'll get a little bit of a taste of the great, you know, social experience that, you know, that college is.
Yeah, I agree with that. That's something I've been a proponent of as well. You can come out of high school, but if you go to college, you should stay for the 2 years. I think that'd be great. I have no optimism, Mike, that's ever going to change given the rules we have in place at the NBA, but I think that's the right way to go.
Well, I don't think it's really not the NBA. I mean, the NBA would like to do it. Some parts of it has been college. You know, I mean, as far as, you know, their rules, as far as if you declare being able to go stay in or go out, mm-hmm. and how it goes. And the biggest deterrent at some case, you know, basically is the Players Association. And I'm still trying to figure that one out. I mean, I got it back in the 90s when, you know, there was no cap on rookie salaries coming in. And the greatest thing that ever happened to veteran players was some rookie coming in getting a 10-year, $100 million contract, mm-hmm. you know, and because then if the guy doesn't live up to expectations, you've got a guy say, hey, I'm better than that guy. You're paying him $100 million. I mean, that raised the boat. That floated everybody's boat. I get that. But now where it's stair-stepped, and everybody is in for what they're in for, I don't see it as much.
I think it's all about getting to that second contract, right? I mean, you know, these guys, you know, the PA, the union, they want to help these guys get there at a younger age. And that second contract is where the cap comes off, and it's free reign with money.
Yeah, no, I agree with that. But on the other side of it, you have kids coming out before they're ready to come out, and virtually now they're in no man's land with nothing left for them, not getting an education, and they're not making the NBA.
Yeah, and I think, and I'd be curious your opinion on this, I think that the fact that it even went to one and done has probably, you know, saved the college careers of some kids. Now, you can't sort of prove it because you don't know who would have come out and who would have failed, who would have been Taj McDavid and Corleone Young and all these guys that came to the NBA when they were totally unprepared for it. And those were guys like Corleone Young was like, I think he was drafted, but there are a lot of other guys that didn't. I think the one and done's probably, you know, saved a lot of those guys and maybe even kept guys in school 3-4 years when otherwise they would have had no careers.
No, I agree. That's absolutely true, for sure.
Hang on for 1 second for me, because I have to tell my listeners about Blue Apron. Now, you know me, I don't cook very much, but when I do, Blue Apron is the way to go. It is the number one fresh ingredient and recipe delivery service in the country. Its mission, to make incredible home cooking accessible to everyone. It can be delivered to 99% of the continental U.S., and it is a terrific blend of recipes. It's affordable, less than $10 per person per meal. There's a great variety, flexible delivery patterns, easy. Each meal comes with a step-by-step, easy-to-follow recipe card and pre-portioned ingredients that can be prepared in 40 minutes or less. Check out this week's menu and get your first 3 meals free. That's free with free shipping by going to blueapron.com/Mannix. You will love how good it feels, how good it tastes to create incredible home-cooked meals with Blue Apron, so don't wait. That's blueapron.com/Mannix, blueapron.com/Mannix. Blue Apron, a better way to cook.
You're listening to the Vertical Podcast with Chris Mannix.
Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans proudly supports the Vertical Podcast. When it comes to the big decision of choosing a mortgage lender, it's important to work with someone you can trust who has your best interest in mind. And with Rocket Mortgage, you'll get a transparent online process that gives you the confidence to make an informed decision. Don't waste time searching through stacks of paperwork. With Rocket Mortgage, you can securely share your financial info to get a mortgage approval in minutes. You can even adjust the rate and length of your loan in real time to make sure you get the mortgage solution that's right for you. Whether you're looking to buy a home or refinance your existing mortgage, you can lift the burden of getting a home loan with Rocket Mortgage. Skip the bank, skip the waiting, and go completely online at quickenloans.com/audible. Equal housing lender, licensed in all 50 states, NMLS, consumeraccess.org, number 3030. You know, one thing that's I would assume is something that your kids are aware of because they were younger and probably in their early teens when this was all kind of going down. But what happened with the Clippers after you had left with Donald Sterling and how he, you know, and all the things that went down there? Do they ask about that? I mean, you worked for Sterling for a long time. Do they ask you about the kind of man he was and what that experience was like for you?
Yeah, I've had guys, you know, ask me about it. And basically, you know, what it comes down to is, you know, obviously he's a strange cat. I mean, from day one, you knew going in that it was going to be a wild ride. You know, before I got there, I knew this for a fact that, you know, that four other times he had not paid his coaches and made them sue him, and that he did that in his business practices a lot. And that he did lots of things that, you know, you might not consider to be normal or mainstream. And, you know, like even in my case, I tried to, have my contract structured in a way, you know, where I had an arbitration clause, loser pays legal fees. But, you know, all of a sudden, one day he decides, okay, you're not my coach, you're not my general manager, and I want like $2 million back. I'm like, what? I said, so it's like you're going to walk in my house and you put a gun to my head and say, I'm going to rob you of $2 million. It's not going to happen. And then, you know, I go through a long legal battle with him over like 18 months, which, you know, I win, but, you know, it could have cost me $750,000 in, you know, fees if I lost. I mean, it's just, you know, just putting that pressure on somebody because you got more money than they do. And, you know, a lot of that was his practice, you know, what he did. So, you know, it branched out into other areas. And, you know, I basically what I would say to them is that he's a guy that would, you wouldn't know from one minute to next what his reaction was going to be to something. And wasn't somebody at times that you could talk in a rational way and say, okay, 2 and 2 equals 4, let's do this. You know, that wasn't a part of the process. You had to figure out other ways. When the answer was no, you had to try and figure out. And you know what? I mean, I got to say, man, I lasted there 8 years, way mm-hmm. more than anybody else lasted, and set up the program from a nothing program to where it is today. I mean, basically, you know, I drafted Blake Griffin and, you know, Chris Kamen, Blake Griffin, DeAndre Jordan, stockpile first round picks and had salary cap space to go after LeBron James, Chris Paul, and Dwight Howard at the time. And one of the things I thought I got fired maybe was because I was talking to him in terms of LeBron James, how much money we were going to need to spend to try and recruit him. Like Mr. Sterling, we have to fly like private jets. We have to pick him up on a private jet, bring him to LA, you know, do all these different things. And I can just see the dollar signs going off in his head. Like, what, are you nuts? I said, no, look, even if we don't get the guy, just the fact that we have a shot, and I knew we had a shot at him. He loved our roster. He told a good friend of mine, he goes, I love your roster. I love everything about your team except your owner. He said, I don't think you can trust the guy. And I'm like, no. You don't have to worry about that. You know, it's LeBron James. And then like 2 weeks later, I was gone. My buddy called me back and said, oh, yeah, you got to trust the guy, right? So, it's you know, anyway, it was a wild ride. But you know, I love living in LA and I love the opportunity to have a chance to help build that program. And for the most part, I talked him into doing things he would never, you know, do before. Building that practice facility was a part of my deal to come coach. So I said, I'll come for less money, take more bonuses, but I got to have a practice facility that's state of the art, as good as anybody in the league. And if you do that, I will get players, and it worked.
I would think that some things that your kids now are aware of is the racial component and all the things that went down there. I mean, how much of that, how much do they ask about that? How much did you experience, you know, firsthand of that side of Donald Sterling when you were there?
Yeah, I would say this, that I never really thought that there were any, actually racial overtones. He was more prejudiced against white players than he was black players. So as far as players were concerned, the only place you had to really argue is if you ever wanted to bring a white player in. I mean, so that was kind of weird. I'm like, look, listen, what does it matter what color a guy's skin is? It's about basketball. We got no colors here. The guy can play. And I didn't know. I never experienced it in that regard.
What did you see in DeAndre Jordan back in 2008? Because he was a second round pick, and you know, people saw, I think, the raw potential, but I'm not sure anybody saw the, you know, kind of the all NBA type player he's developed into.
Well, I got to tell you you brought that up. I'm going to tell you a great story. Okay, so we saw DeAndre, and he had this great body. He had great explosion and size, and I mean, like, this guy should lead the league in rebounding and block shots, is what you think right away when you see him. Okay. And, he's fallen. And I was sitting there looking at him going, wow, it's amazing. You know, we had him pegged to go like 16 or 17 in the draft. And right two slots before we get to pick, I get two calls from two teams offering us so much money for that second round pick. And the two, and actually, so it was right in front of us. So we had a couple of players were on the board. Chalmers was on the board, and DeAndre Jordan was on the board. So I knew I was going to get somebody really good. Anyway, teams called up, offers a bunch of money. And if I had asked Sterling, hey, do you want to take these millions of dollars for this second round pick? There's no question where he would have gone. And basically, I turned him down to save him from himself. I said, hold on 1 second. And I put the phone on hold, and I just said to myself, look, this kid's going to be really good. You know, this amount of money, you know, it would be such a mistake. So anyway, I came back and told him no, and the rest is history.
Good thing you did, because the guy's turned out to be a pretty kind of a mainstay out there in LA. Do you believe that big men can learn ways to shoot free throws better? I mean, we've seen even in the NBA, the kid down in Houston, shooting underhanded free throws now as a way of doing it. A guy like DeAndre Jordan would be unstoppable if he could shoot better than, you know, 50% from the free throw line. Do you believe big men can find ways to learn to shoot free throws better?
I got to think you got to figure out doing something. You got to keep trying different things. And, I played with Rick Barry, you know, virtually certainly one of the greatest top three, at least, you know, greatest free throw shooters of all time. And I heard different guys saying, you know, along the way that they wouldn't even try it because how it would look. Mm-hmm. And I felt like that's so shallow. I mean, if this can help you, try it. Give this guy, this Hall of Fame great player, a chance to teach you his methods. Look at his son. His son right now is at University of Florida, just set the all-time record for free throw shooting there. And, the thing that Rick always told me when we played on the Houston Rockets together, and one year we had like the top four, we had four guys in the top 10 in free throw shooting in the league. Rick and Calvin Murphy were 1 and 2 at around over 90%. And then I think Mike Newland and I were like 86 or 87%. We would do this, and I said, well, I'm in the mid 80s as a free throw shooter. I'm not going underhand at this point, but I get it. And he used to say that because he would never get tired late in games. You know, sometimes he feels like, you know, you miss shots in games because you're fatigued. He said, I never have that because, you know, the way I use my arms, and it's all legs. And I tried it some, and I could make them. And I think it's a way softer shot for some guys. And, I think they should all try it. If you're anywhere around 50% as a free throw shooter, you should try standing on your head and kicking the ball in if somebody thought they could teach you the right way, because again, it's such a value. I had Vin Baker. I drafted him out of Hartford. And he came in and he was in the 50s as a shooter. And we spent a lot of time I actually hired Andy Enfield, who's the coach at USC now, as a shooting coach, because Andy's resume, like I used to read all these resumes, and came in and said, hey, I'm the leading free throw shooter in NCAA history at like, I don't know, like 92%. I said, all right, that gets my attention. Brought him in and said, all right, here's one of my players. Show me how you would teach him. Let me watch you teach. And I liked what I saw, and I hired him. And part of his job, we paid him on a, you know, an incentive basis, you know, a flat fee plus incentives. And, you know, he improved Vin Baker from, you know, mid-50s to about 68% on a guy that's a volume free throw shooter. That's a great thing to happen.
Do you remember anything about what you tried to do with DeAndre those first couple of years you had him? Because he was below 40% in both those first two seasons.
You know, the thing about DeAndre is that you could put him on a free throw line in practice and he can make free throws. I mean, I've seen him make 14 or 15 in a row.
Yeah.
And if you look at his shot, I mean, there's a lot of guys out there who are bad free throw shooters, and you look at their shot, and I would say to you, that is ugly. That thing has no chance going in. DeAndre's shot is actually, the form on his shot is actually pretty good. You know, part of it's got to be mental, you know, what you're thinking. I mean, you know, when I was a rookie in the NBA, I was always a really, really good free throw shooter, but I wasn't making free throws because my time was sporadic as a rookie, whatever, mentally. And I would find myself going to the free throw line and praying, oh, please, God, let me make this free throw type. And one time I was thinking to myself, I said, hold it, wait a second. Okay, it's great to pray, but, you know, this is right now it's a negative. It's putting a negative thought in your head. You're thinking about missing as opposed to making. And then I started saying, wait a second, you're a great free throw shooter. And the reason you're a great free throw shooter is you practice so much, you deserve your success. So I changed my whole routine to start saying to myself, the last thing I say on a free throw is up and in. So that I put that in my head, I see a visual, I say up and in. It's virtually two things that are real positive as far as shooting is concerned. I mean, the better arc you put on the ball, the better chance the ball is going in the basket. And then the last word you say in, you're seeing the ball go through. So I think there's certain things you got to get to, and you got to get your head straight. And the biggest part of it is you got to believe that the ball deserves to go in the basket. And however you can get your head to believe that is what you should do. And if it takes, you know, shooting, I mean, I've been in certain situations, you know, where I look at a guy's shot and his form, and clearly you could say, yeah, look, your elbow's coming away from your body, you know, you got a little bit of a chicken wing there, you're not following through. There's all certain things you could analyze and correct, but until the guy starts seeing the ball go in the basket, he's not necessarily going to be a believer. And I think a big part of it is is mental. And he's got to get that breakthrough.
Yeah, I remember Stan Van Gundy saying something similar about Andre Drummond. In practice, he'd seen him be 70%. Then in games, it just something clicks in his head, and it just gets mental with him. So yeah, I think you're 100%.
Yeah, I've got a kid right now. It's his first year, and you know he's shooting below 50, and yet he'll come in the gym at night and shoot between 80 and 100.
Yeah.
So it's between the years, and you got to figure out that connection and how to get it and about staying positive with them and to get that breakthrough.
How much do your kids now remember the Portland Trailblazers teams? Incredibly talented, incredibly combustible. Those, I mean, they might be a little bit too young, I guess, for that, but do they remember any of those guys at all?
Yeah. I'm not sure. I mean, some guys do. Some people bring stuff up. I mean, the most, you know, probably memorable player from that team is probably Rasheed Wallace.
Yeah,
because he went on, you know, to Detroit and he won a championship and stayed around a little bit. But not really. I mean, players know great players. So along the way they hear about them or they see things on YouTube or. Go back in their video games. I mean, I had no clue about this. One of the guys said, oh, coach, man, you won me a game last night. I'm like, I did what? He said, yeah, I was playing a video game and I used you. He said, man, you were drilling him from 3-point land. I'm like, what are you talking about? He says, yeah, one of his teams, you can pick, like, you could be on it. And I used you. And he said, yeah, you made shots. It was great. So I said, so if I'm in it, if I'm in some of those games playing, then clearly these other guys are too. So they get that, you know, they get to know them.
When you look back at those Blazers years, were they as crazy as they seemed from the outside? I mean, you had some characters on that team, from Rasheed to, you know, Scottie Pippen in that last year. Sean Kemp was on that team. Plus, I mean, you go down the list. I mean, everyone seemed to have, or at least half the team had, big personalities.
Yes and no. I liked coaching those teams. You know, early on when I got there, I told Bob Witt that you got tremendous athletes here and you've made the playoffs the last 5 years, but you've been knocked out in the first round every year. And big part of it is you win with character. I think some of these guys don't have the right character. I said, look, we need to, and I understand, you know, that what it takes to move guys. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to get these guys numbers that I want to move. And I'm just telling you right now, just don't fall back in love with them. You know, we just got to move guys and get, you know, real quality guys in that are good players that'll play hard when things get bad. And, you know, there's a lot of ups and downs in an NBA season, and you got to get through it. And guys with mental toughness are the ones that will get through it for you. And those are guys come playoff time that'll fight when they get down, and you know, and give yourself a chance to come back and win. And so we did that. And I like coaching those teams. Obviously, the team that we had, we lost that game 7 against the Lakers. We were down 3-1. Came back to tie it up and then get to the 7th game in LA and have a 14-point lead going into the fourth quarter, and we lose a game. And, you know, I watched people say, oh, my, that game's got to be a terrible game for you to watch. I said, actually, no, I like watching that game. I thought it was a great game for us, and I wouldn't change virtually anything in the game. I mean, people say, well, but that team choked. I said, really? Like, what's your version of choking? Because if you look in that fourth quarter, we had one turnover, so that's not choking. We took care of the basketball. We had one defensive mistake on a rotation. That was by Rasheed Wallace when he came back into the game after being subbed out. And we had a stretch where we missed 13 straight shots. 11 of them were great shots, and 2 of them were only good shots. One was by a 20-footer by Scottie Pippen, which he was open, but you know, he wasn't a great outside shooter. He's better at playmaking and driving, but it wasn't a bad shot. And, you know, like 4 shots went in and out. And then at the end of the game, I say to you, you know, so we were, I thought we'd still win the game until Sabonis fouled out with 4 minutes to go. He had 4 fouls with 6 minutes left to go in the game. He had 6 fouls with 4 minutes left to go in the game. And that was the killer for us. If you add up, we played those guys, 11 times that year, and if you added up all the points in all 11 games, they beat us by 1 point. But if you took all the times, you took all the minutes, you added up when Sabonis was on the floor, our points were way better than theirs. So, you know, he was a big key for us because, you know, Shaq's size, not that, you know, Sabas couldn't stop him, clearly, but he could deter him enough to where we could get some help there at times because his body, you know, because he was, you know, that's he had great size as well.
So my takeaway from all that is you miss Bonzi Wells is what we're.
I love Bonzi Wells. Bonzi's my guy. you know, Bonzi, you know, I saw Bonzi out last spring. I was in Indiana. I was watching an AAU tournament, and he's part owner or manager of a facility that we were playing with in Indiana, and talked to him about coaching and how he's trying to help kids. And yeah, it was great. Yeah, so I love Bonzi Wells, and the other guy is totally misunderstood, is Rasheed Wallace. You know, I mean, he set a world record for technical fouls when I coached him. They had to put that rule in, you know, to take. I think it was like 41, and you know, and I kept trying to get our management to say, look, we got to stop this ourselves because it, you know, it can be costly, and you know, like suspend them after a certain period of time because nobody's gonna want them to take all that money away from them. If he doesn't care, his wife's going to kick his ass. You know, I mean, 40, 50 grand a shot, you know, that, for a suspension, that's real money. But you know, Rasheed was a great teammate. All his teammates loved him. I never once did he ever ask me, I need more shots. Actually, it's the opposite way. I mean, one time you have to notice about him, and I had a coach around this, came into the game at the end of a game, we're down one and last possession. I came into the huddle, and I said, okay, I want to run this Rasheed play here. And Rasheed goes, no, coach, I don't want to play. I want to play. Run for somebody else. Well, people would say, well, Hal, the guy doesn't want the ball at the end of the game. Is he scared? You know, what's the deal? And it wasn't that way with him. He just never wanted to be in the spotlight. He wanted to deflect, and he wanted the other guys to have the spotlight. And he just wanted, you know, but he wanted to win. And so I said, okay. All right, so here's the deal. All right, Rasheed, you set this pick for Scotty. Scotty, you come along the baseline. Damon, when Scotty comes around that pick, you hit him. Scotty, you bury that, you know, 17-foot jumper. Let's bury it and go home. I said, but if you're not open, throw the ball into Rasheed. So then we walked away from the huddle. I grabbed Damon and I grabbed Scotty. I said, if either one of you guys think about shooting the ball, I'll bench you the next game. Throw the freaking ball into Rasheed. Throw the ball into him, turn right shoulder, bank shot, we win. And it wasn't that he didn't want or didn't think he could do it. It was just that, you know, he wanted his other teammates to have the limelight.
That's great. Before I let you go, the 6 wins this year for you guys. I mean, obviously you're trying to build something from scratch. Have you been, are you heartened by what you've seen for most of this year? Do you see the foundation of something? I mean, how do you feel now at the end of the season?
I feel great. I think our guys have improved. I mean, our last 4 or 5, 6 games, we've been so close to winning. We won our last game. The game before against Memphis, we were up at the half. We didn't play a great second half and lost, but we lost in double overtime to Temple at Temple, and we missed 2 layups in the last minute that would have sealed the game for us. You know, we had a 15-point lead at SMU and lost by single digits, and, you know, and they're a team that's won, you know, like 24 out of the last 25 games. So I've seen a lot of improvement in these players. So, and the fact is, most of the guys that come in and see us play or cover the game say, you know, I can't believe, like, your guys act like they think they're good and, like, they're going to win every game. And I said, that's because they do. I mean, I talked in terms of this year, like, fellas, look, you're picked unanimously to be last in this conference, okay? I mean, so what I'm telling you is we got one way of getting into the NCAAs, and that's to win our conference tournament. And so basically we got to look at this whole season as a training camp. And we're going to build and build and build, and we want to peak by the time we get to our conference tournament. And we'll have seen teams play, you know, most cases twice. We'll play them twice. We'll have a good book on them, figure them out, and give ourselves a chance to win. And that's what it's all about. You go out and play hard, give yourself a chance to win. And our last 5 or 6 games against good, you know, teams, we've been there. We've given ourselves a chance to win.
Well, glad to hear you're enjoying this move to college, Mike. Good luck in this upcoming tournament, and I really appreciate you taking some time to join me here on the podcast.
My pleasure, Chris. Anytime.
That's it for this week's episode. My thanks to Mike Dunleavy for joining the show. A reminder, you can listen to Archive Podcast at iTunes, TuneIn, Stitcher, really anywhere you can download podcasts. If you have time, post a comment, leave us a rating. I really appreciate it, and I'll see you next week.
This has been a digital media production. Find your voice.